See, so many of us, it's not very much money anyhow. 800 here and 1200 there and 500 here and 900 over there and 250 over here. But there's so many of them, we can't do it all at once. But we can take them one at a time and work our way through them and gradually get rid of them. Now, I hear some of you saying, and again, I hear awful good. I hear some of you saying, well, Charlie, that's probably right. For 1,000, 1,200, 5,000. But Charlie, how about 50,000? How about 150,000? How about 250,000? How about 500,000? How about 1,000,000? Can we pay those people off? Well, I don't see why not. If we're smart enough to steal it. We're probably smart enough to pay it off. Right. You know, I think we forget from step three on that God's going to be with us. And if we're willing to do these things, God's going to make it possible. See, we're not alone anymore. We've got God with us all the way. We have an old friend that used to live in Tulsa, Oklahoma. He now lives out in Bakersfield, California. His name is Dan. We celebrated Dan's 43rd AA birthday this year. And when Dan was 29 years sober, he said to me, Charlie, I paid the last one of them off last week. I said, Dan, how do you feel? And Dan said, I feel about 8 foot tall. Now, Dan is about 5'1", little bitty guy. He said, this is the first time in my life that I can ever remember that I don't owe somebody something for what I've stolen from them in the past. And he said, I feel pretty good about old Dan. Just took him 29 years to do it. When Dan was drinking, he was in the oil business down in Texas. And he hooked them good, too. Took him 29 years to pay them back, but he did it. I tell you how good Dan was at hooking people. His wife, Sarah, beautiful, beautiful Al-Anon lady. Whenever Dan was still drinking down in Texas, one day Sarah took him to the state insane asylum to have him committed for alcoholic insanity. The head psychiatrist first interviewed Sarah, then he interviewed Dan. And after a while, Dan left and Sarah was locked up. She stayed there for a year.
She did. Yeah.
She learned how to live better electrically. And always after that, she said, I have forgiven him for everything except one. She said, I'll never forgive that son of a bitch for that.
That's a true story, too. Okay. Now we deal with direct amends. As we go through this, we're going to look at other kind of amends that's possible. There are a lot of different things that can come up in making amends. But as Charlie and I, we always go back to the book. We need a sponsor here maybe to direct us, to know how to handle some of these things. But we have a lot of information in the big book, too. I've never seen an amend that I couldn't find an answer in the big book. To that type of a man. The next one, we deal with direct amends.
Most of the rest of this now is going to deal with where other people are involved.
That's right.
Not all of them, but most of them. Let's look at the criminal offense.
The next paragraph deals with criminal offenses. Perhaps we have committed a criminal offense which might land us in jail if it were known to authorities. We may be short in our accounts and unable to make good. We have already admitted this in confidence to another person in step five. But we are sure we would be in prison or lose our job if it was known. Maybe it's only a petty offense such as padding the expense account. Most of us have done that sort of thing. Maybe we are divorced and have remarried and haven't kept up with the alimony to number one. She is indignant about it, and she has a warrant out for arrest. That's a common form of troubles, too. Although these repatriations take numerous forms, there are some general principles which we find guiding. reminding ourselves we have decided to go to any length to find a spiritual experience. We ask that we be given the strength and direction to do the right thing, no matter what the personal consequences may be. We may lose our position, our reputation, or face jail, but we are willing. We have to be. We must not shrink at anything. Now, the next one is going to talk about others involved. Usually, however, other persons are involved. Therefore, we are not too hasty and foolish martyrs who would needlessly sacrifice others to save himself from the alcoholic snake pit. A man we know had married remarried because of resentment and drinking. He had not paid alimony to his first wife. She was furious. She went to the court and got an order for his arrest. He had commenced our way of life, had secured a position, and was getting his head above water. It would have been impressive heroics if he had walked to the judge and said, "Here I am." We thought he ought to be willing to do that if necessary, but if he were in jail, he would provide nothing for either family. We suggested he write his first wife, admitting his faults, and asking forgiveness. He did, and sent a small amount of money. He told her what he would try to do in the future. He said he was perfectly willing to go to jail if she insisted. Of course, she did not, and the whole situation has long been adjusted.
There's a deal where other persons are involved. Now, the alimony thing is not, you know, such a common thing today through the new divorce laws and et cetera. A lot of the no-fault divorces, you don't find too many people owing too much money and back alimony payments. But I tell you one thing we are encountering today which needs to be looked at, and those are child support payments. You know, lots of people in AA today who have fathered 2, 3, and 4 children and left them behind, and the wife has gotten out a warrant for their arrest. And sooner or later, if they don't do something about that, they're going to catch up with them, and they're going to end up going to jail just like they used to go to jail for not paying alimony payments. I've got a fellow I was working with back a few months ago, and he's got 2 children from a first marriage, and she filed some papers on him because he wasn't paying his child support payments. And he came to me and he said, "Well, what do you think I ought to do?" And I said, "I think you ought to make your payments." He said, "Well, hell, she won't even let me see the kids. I'll be damned if I'm going to make any payment." And I said, "That's beside the point. You fathered the children, they're yours. And you're responsible for them the same as she is. You better make your payments." "By God, I'm not going to do it." I said, "Fine." Next thing I heard from him, he called me one night about 3 o'clock in the morning, and he was in the county jail. He said, "Would you come and get me out of jail?" And I said, "Well, what are you in there for?" He said, "Well, they arrested me for not paying the payments." I said, "Hell, I'm not going to come get you." I said, "I told you several months ago what's going to happen to you. Why don't you just lay in there and think about that for a while? Maybe if you think about it long enough, you'll start making your payments when you get out of jail." It's not a question of whether we want to or not. It's not even a question of whether child support payments are right or not. The question is, if the court says we're going to have to pay them, we better pay them, or we're probably going to go to jail over that sooner or later. I think we need to look at that. And of course, as far as I'm concerned, I'm old enough to be of the old school. Hell, if I fathered them, by God, I'm responsible for them. And I think we ought to be the same way today. Let's go over to page 80. Before taking drastic action which might implicate other people, we secure their consent.
Yeah.
If we've obtained permission, have consulted with others, asked God to help, and the drastic step is indicated, we must not shrink. Here's how, if it's going to involve others, we can still make the amends if we will go to them and get their permission to do so in some cases. This brings to mind a story about one of our friends. While drinking, he accepted a sum of money from a bitterly hated business rival, giving him no receipt for it. He subsequently denied having received the money and used the incident as a basis for discrediting the man. He thus used his own wrongdoing as a means of destroying the reputation of another. In fact, his rival was ruined. He felt that he had done a wrong he could not possibly make right. If he opened that old affair, he was afraid it would destroy the reputation of his partner, his new business partner, disgrace his family, and take away his means of livelihood. What right had he to involve those dependent upon him? How could he possibly make a public statement exonerating his rival? After consulting with his wife and partner, he came to the conclusion it was better to take those risks than to stand before his Creator guilty of such ruinous slander. He thought he had to place the outcome in God's hands, or he would soon start drinking again and all would be lost anyhow. He attended church for the first time in many years. After the sermon, he quietly got up and made an explanation. His action met widespread approval, and today he is one of the most trusted citizens of his town. This all happened years ago. There's where sometimes, if it's going to involve others and may hurt others, we need to go to them and talk with them and discuss it with them and get their permission to go ahead and make the amends before we do anything. Because you see, if in making the amends we end up hurting somebody else, then we're going to have to end up later on going right back making some more amends. Page 80 and 81 deals with domestic troubles, sex outside of marriage.
Next paragraph. He talks about the chances are we have domestic troubles. Perhaps we'll mix up with a woman in a fashion we wouldn't care to advertise. We doubt if this, in this respect, alcoholics are fundamentally much worse than other people. Same problem other people have. But drinking does complicate sex relations in the home. After a few years with the alcoholic, the wife gets worn out, resentful, uncommunicative. How could she be anything else? The husband begins to feel sorry for himself. He commences to look around nightclubs. Are there equivalent for something besides liquor? Perhaps he is having a secret, exciting affair with a girl who understands. In fairness, we must say that she may understand. But what are we going to do about a thing like that? A man so involved often feels very remorseful at times, especially if he is married to a loyal and courageous girl who has literally gone through hell for him. Whatever the situation, we must usually have to do something about it. If we are sure our wife does not know, should we tell her? Not always, we think. If she knows in a general way that we have been wild, should we tell her in detail? Undoubtedly, we should admit our faults. She may insist on knowing all the particulars. She wants to know who the woman is and where she is. We feel we ought to say to her that we have no right to involve another person. We are sorry for what we have done, and God willing, it shall not be repeated. More than that, we cannot do. We have no right to go further. Though there may be justifiable exceptions, and though we wish to lay down no rule of any sort, we have often found this the best course to take.
Of course, sometimes we find that the shoe fits the other foot too. You know, this is written to men, but in many cases, the woman has been the one going out and found somebody else in the bar too. So really, he's advising both sides of the fence here. And I'll guarantee you, as a man, if my wife's been out there fooling around with somebody, I don't want to know it. And I sure as hell don't want to know who it was. You know, if our wives, our husbands, think we might be out there fooling around, hell, they're not dummies. You know, if we're out there fooling around, they probably know that. What good would it do to walk in there and make it a surety, make it a solid fact, and then name names after names after names after names? All we're doing is hurting them that much further. The best thing I can do as a husband, if I've been out there playing around, which I did some, and most of us did, the best thing I can do is say to my wife, look, I know what I was doing, and you know what I was doing too. And I want you to know I'm real sorry about that, and I'm going to do my damnedest not to do that anymore. I'm trying to straighten my life out, and from this day on, I'm going to try to live by a set of principles which prohibits me from doing that, and I'm going to try to be the best husband I can. And that's all I can do. The next thing I have to do is live by these principles and be the best husband I can, and eventually show her that I really mean business. I found out that's all I can do to my kids. I couldn't make any amends to my kids other than going to them and say, look, when I was drinking, I did some things that hurt you, and I know I did. You know it too. And I want you to know I'm sorry about that, and I ask your forgiveness. And I'm trying to change my life now, and from this day on, I'm going to try to be the best father I can be. And then I start trying to be the best father I can be. And eventually it all works its way out if I'll go ahead and do those things that I'm supposed to be doing. But it certainly doesn't hurt or doesn't do any good to name names, dates, and particulars. We just hurt people further that way. Let's go over on page 83. Third paragraph. There may be some wrongs we can never fully right. You know, some of these people, if we tried to make amends to them, it would hurt them even further. Or just as importantly, in making the amends, it may hurt some other people. Some of these people are already dead and buried, and we can never fully right those kind of amends. We don't worry about them. If we can honestly say to ourselves that we would right them if we could. Some people cannot be seen, and we send them an honest letter. There may be a valid reason for postponement in some cases, but we don't delay if it can be avoided. We should be sensible, tactful, considerate, and humble, without being servile or scrapy. As God's people, we stand on our feet. We don't crawl before anyone. And sometimes, in our zeal to have everybody like us, we go to somebody to make our amends and they don't accept it. And we're just crushed by that. And we tend to want to go back and go back and go back and literally beg these people to forgive us. We don't need to do that. We make our amends. If they don't accept it, there's not a thing we can do about that. The best thing we can do is hold ourselves in readiness to make the amend when we can and go right on about our business, and life's going to be okay. The question always comes up, well, don't you owe yourself some amends? Yeah, I think we do. You know, I don't hold with the idea that I never hurt anybody while drinking but me. I hurt everybody I ever touched. But I'll guarantee you I hurt me just as bad as I ever hurt anybody. And I think the finest amend that I can make to me is to clear away the wreckage of the past. To get rid of that guilt and remorse. To get rid of that fear. To get rid of those things that are holding me back. And if I make my amends to the best of my ability, and that guilt and that remorse begins to leave that back room, then once more, God's not going to allow a hole in my head. It's going to be filled with peace of mind, serenity, happiness, self-esteem. It's amazing as we make these amends how much better we feel about ourselves. People keep talking to us about a lack of self-esteem. Well, sure, we got a lack of self-esteem. But the way we get it is to work these steps. And as we get right with God, and as we get right with ourselves, and as we get right with our fellow man, then we're going to have self-esteem. Just think. For people who have been spiritually bankrupt, mentally bankrupt, physically bankrupt for years, all of a sudden now, we're well in all three dimensions of life. My God, we're going to feel great. The book describes how we're going to feel at the bottom of page 83 and on into 84, Joe.
Okay, now we have the promises that become as a result of these steps. If we are painstaking about this phase of our development, we'll be amazed.
Which phase?
This phase.
The amends phase.
We'll be amazed before we are halfway through. We're going to know a new freedom and a new happiness. We will not regret the past or wish to shut the door on it. We will comprehend the word serenity, and we will know peace. No matter how far down the scale we have gone, we will see how our experience can benefit others. The feeling of uselessness and self-pity will disappear. We will lose interest in selfish things and gain interest as our fellows. Self-seeking will slip away. Our whole attitude, not look upon life, will change. fear of people and economic insecurity will leave us. We will intuitively know how to handle situations which used to baffle us. We will suddenly realize that God is doing for us what we cannot do for ourselves. Are these extravagant promises? We think not. They are being fulfilled among us sometimes quickly.
Spiritual experience.
Sometimes slowly.
Spiritual awakening.
They will always materialize if we work for them. Now we see these promises, as we call them, are the results of the steps, the moral personality change after steps 8 and 9. And we can see that we have put our lives into order already with these first 9 steps, real simply. And we are living, we are in the design that God created. Therefore, these things are just natural to our lives. You know, promises always come as results of work. They always, you never see promises don't stand alone. No one promises you something for nothing. Promises are always associated with work. Charlie said he experienced it, and I experienced it one Monday night at our meeting. There was a new man there at the meeting, first meeting he ever come to. And I seen an older member talking to him, reading to him out of the book. And I said, Arthur, that's good. I'm sure glad him gets him started with the book. So I asked him, what was he reading to the new man? And he said he was reading him the promises. I said, what in the hell are you reading him the promises for? I said, did you read what went in front of the promises? He said, no. I said, how in the hell is he going to get the promises if he don't know what to do? You know, the promises won't come unless you do the work. Promises are always associated with work. And I love what it says. These will always materialize. This is very positive if we work for them.
I'm going to read them again. And I'm going to read them for two reasons. Number one is I love the way I read them. But the real reason is I want to add a few words to them. And these words I'm going to add to them are going to be my own words. They refer to a time when I was young, when I could drink alcohol, and alcohol was my friend. I could be Fred Astaire on the dance floor. And the world's greatest lover in the back seat of a 36 Chevrolet. This is the way alcohol used to make me feel before it turned against me and literally destroyed me. Whenever I took a drink of alcohol, I knew a new freedom and a new happiness. Whenever I took a drink of alcohol, I did not regret the past or wish to shut the door on it. Whenever I took a drink of alcohol, I would comprehend the word serenity and I would know peace. Whenever I took a drink of alcohol, no matter how far down the scale I had gone, I could see how my experience would benefit others. Whenever I took a drink of alcohol, that feeling of uselessness and self-pity would disappear. Whenever I took a drink of alcohol, I would lose interest in selfish things and gain interest in my fellows. Whenever I took a drink of alcohol, self-seeking would slip away. Whenever I took a drink of alcohol, my whole attitude and outlook upon life would change. Whenever I took a drink of alcohol, fear of people and economic insecurity would leave me. Whenever I took a drink of alcohol, I would intuitively know how to handle situations which used to baffle me. Whenever I took a drink of alcohol, I would suddenly realize that alcohol was doing for me what I could not do for myself. Now let's think about that for a minute. My God, no wonder I love to drink. Anytime you find anything that will give you those feelings, my God, you're going to love it. And as that young kid growing up, standing on the outside of the crowd looking in, never could be a part of. And I took that drink of alcohol, and it gave me all these wonderful feelings. And I couldn't wait to try it again. And by golly, it did it the second time. And it did it the third time, and it did it the fourth time. And alcohol became the greatest friend that I ever had. And I used alcohol for years to get these feelings. And as I look back in that part of my life now, I couldn't have functioned in normal society without alcohol or something to give me these feelings. But one day, my great friend, alcohol, turned against me. And all the things that I was afraid would happen now begin to happen because of the alcohol itself. And I was a very, very confused individual. I didn't know I was alcoholic. And I didn't know that I could never recapture these great feelings from alcohol. And I spent the last 5 or 6 years of my drinking desperately trying to recapture these feelings, not knowing I would never be able to do that. And I almost destroyed me in the process. And I came to AA, and you handed me a book. And in that book, I found a little program of action. And I applied the first 9 steps to my life to the best of my ability. And one morning, I woke up with a full realization that these first 9 steps are giving me everything good that alcohol ever gave me when I was a young fellow. That's why I don't drink. If I didn't find them here, I'd look for them somewhere else. And the only other place I know to find them is in alcohol. And I'd go right back to it trying to find it again. See, this is the miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous. That's why we don't need to drink today, because we've already got it right here through these first 9 steps. Why should I drink when I've already got it? And about the same time, another realization hit me too. By golly, the first 9 steps have never turned against me as alcohol did. I've never been placed in jail because of the first 9 steps. Nobody's ever drugged me into a divorce court because of the first 9 steps. Nobody's ever beat the hell out of me because of the first 9 steps. I've never vomited. Damn near did a time or two, but I've never really vomited because of the first 9 steps. You see, this is the miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous. We get all the good, and we get none of the bad. Therefore, we don't need to drink. Joe said we're through for this afternoon. Thank you all for being here. Yeah, great. Morning, everybody. My name is Charlie Farman. I'm a very grateful recovering alcoholic. Because I'm a member of the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, and by the grace of the power that I found in the 12-step program of Alcoholics Anonymous, I haven't found it necessary to take a drink for 9,517 days today, one day at a time, and for this I'm very grateful. Oh, you guys really look good this morning. Right with God and right with yourself and right with your fellow man, and you received all the promises and you had a spiritual experience and you're in great shape this morning.
Fine.
Joe's going to start us off with a little story, I think, this morning.
My name is Joe. I'm a real alcoholic. Through God's grace, but working in my life one day at a time as a result of these steps, I haven't found it necessary to take a drink since March of 62. You know, Charlie said, you know, we always try to lighten these things up with a little story. One of my favorites here lately is about the Pope. The Pope recently came to New York, you know, he on a tour. And, you know, he would be riding around every day in his beautiful white limousine with smoke lindas, and they would carry him around to different places. And he came down there from his suite early one morning, and the chauffeur was out there, the guy that drove him around. And he was just visiting with the chauffeur, and he said, you know, I kind of, you know, in what I do, you know, I'm kind of away from the, don't ever get to do the real things that other people get to do. I never have an opportunity to just do the ordinary thing with ordinary people, just like you driving this car. He said, you get to drive around town. He said, I never have that opportunity. And the chauffeur said, oh, we can take care of that. He said, would you like to drive this morning? He said, I'll get in the back seat, and you put the chauffeur's hat on and get up front. He said, they never would know the difference. He said, yeah, well, let's try it. So the Pope got behind the wheel, and the chauffeur got in the back, and they were driving through the city. Pope hadn't drove for a long time, and the car was riding easy, and he was picking up a little speed. So he passed the two cops in the car, and he was speeding, and these two cops said, that limousine is speeding, said, pull it over. So these two cops took off and pulled the Pope over in the limousine, and one of the cops got out and went up to the window. The other one stayed in the car. And the Pope rolled the window down to see what he wanted, and the cop saw who he was. He just stepped back and said, go ahead on. He let him go. And the cop got back to the car, and the other cop was in there, and he said, you didn't give that guy a ticket? He said, no. He said, he was speeding. He said, you know who was driving that car? He said, the Pope was driving that car. And said, if the Pope is driving, you know who's in the back seat.
Makes sense to me. As we finished up yesterday afternoon, we finished with the promises on page 83 and 84. And I think if we carefully look at those promises, we're going to find that all of them deal with the mind, and none of them deal with the body. And if we receive those promises in our minds, then surely we've become entirely different people. We started out way back in the beginning as restless, irritable, discontented people. People filled with shame, fear, guilt, and remorse. And as we worked our way through those steps, we found that that restlessness and irritability and discontent began to disappear. We found that the shame, fear, guilt, and remorse began to disappear. We found that the old resentments and fears began to disappear. And we receive those promises in our mind, and we have become entirely different people. We've probably undergone a personality change sufficient to recover from alcoholism right here at the end of step 9. Now, if that's true, then the question always comes up, well, if you've already had a personality change, then what do you need the last 3 steps for? And quite often we hear people say, well, the last 3 steps are there to maintain our sobriety. Now, we will agree that the last 3 steps are there and will help us stay sober. But we don't really think that's the reason behind those last 3 steps. In the first place, to maintain something is almost an impossibility over an extended period of time. Because there's another law that applies that says nothing in our universe ever stays the same. Everything that we know is either growing or it's dying. It's either progressing or it's regressing. It's either going forward or it's going back. To maintain something means to keep it as is. And that's really a misnomer, because we can't keep anything as is. We believe that the last 3 steps are designed not only to help us stay sober, but really to continue the growth that we've made up to this point. Twice in the big book, once in Bill's story and once in chapter 2, he mentioned a fourth dimension of existence that they never even dreamed of. Now, we've looked at the normal 3 dimensions. The spirit and the mind and the physical. And we've been able to see where those first 9 steps put us back together and made us well in those 3 dimensions. But now then, Bill talks about a dimension far, far beyond those 3. It's a dimension you can't describe. It's a dimension you can't explain. It's one that you can only feel. And the only people that really feel the fourth dimension are those that use the last 3 steps as growth steps rather than maintenance steps. We've made a tremendous amount of spiritual growth through the first 9 steps. But if we tried to stop that growth here, then we would begin to slip back. And the next thing you know, we would start having trouble with people. And that would back up, and we'd have trouble in our minds with ourselves. And then that would back up and block us off from God. And the next thing you know, we're drunk all over again. We really believe this is what happens to AA people who have been in the program for years, who have had a very successful program, but then they tend to stop growing sometimes. And eventually they start slipping back. And the next thing you know, they end up drunk. Just like the lady we talked about in Tulsa, Oklahoma, who got drunk after 21 years of sobriety. That's exactly what happened. So let's take a look at the last 3 steps, and let's see if we can't see the growth factor in them, and see if they're not really designed for us to continue the spiritual growth we've made up to this point. Joe?
Okay. This thought brings us to step 10, which suggests we continue to take personal inventory and continue to set right any mistakes as we go along. We vigorously commence this way of living as we clean up the past. We start on another plane. We have entered the world of the Spirit.
We've had our spiritual awakening, our spiritual experience already.
Our next function is to grow.
To grow, not maintain, not stay where we are, but to grow.
In understanding and effectiveness. This is not an overnight matter. It should continue for a lifetime. Continue to watch for selfishness, dishonesty, resentment, and fear.
What step did we use to look at that in the first place? Anybody remember? Step 4, okay.
When they crop up, we ask God at once to remove them.
What steps did we use there? 6 and 7, okay.
We discuss them with someone immediately.
And what step was that? 5, okay.
And we make amends quicker if we've harmed anyone.
And what steps did we use there? 8 and 9, okay.
Then we resolutely turn our thoughts to someone we could help. So we see that according to the textbook, which is how to work the steps. Step 10 is a continuous daily practice of 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, and 9. Now we also have to remember, as we went through the book, that these were the steps that gave us all of our personality change, the action steps. So step 10 is a continuous practice of all the action steps. You know, if we took step 4 on a daily basis and 5, we would learn a lot more about ourselves. And as we ask God to remove these things, the character defects will become less and less. And as we make amends to other people quickly, our relationship with people in the third dimension would grow. So we can see that these step 10, according to the book, is a continuous use of all the growth steps, of all the action steps. And therefore, we would be growing into the fourth dimension.
The 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous appeared to the world in 1939 in the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, sometime after that, AA made a serious mistake, we think. Sometime after that, they decided to take these steps out of the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous, and put them on little wallet cards to carry in our purses and billfolds, and put them on wall charts and hung them up in the wall in our meeting rooms. Now, the mistake was not taking the steps out of the big book and putting them on cards and wall charts. The mistake was, is when they took them out of the book, they left the directions on how to work them in the book. And people go to an AA meeting, and they read the steps off the wall chart. They interpret them in their mind as to what they think they mean, and then they try to work them accordingly. And the only directions on how to work them is to be found in the book. Now here's what most people do with step 10. It says, continue to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. somewhere we interpreted that step to mean that the only thing we have to look for is to see if we're wrong, and if so, promptly admit it. And then somewhere we got the idea that you don't need to do that until you go to bed at night. Now, at mine and Joe's age, you don't get in trouble in bed very much any longer.
Walking around.
What we need is a walking around step.
I don't need no going to bed step.
And if you really read the directions on step 10, we can see that it's much more than just looking to see if you're wrong and promptly admit it. Let's say I get fouled up at 10 o'clock in the morning, and I find myself mad, or I find myself afraid or worried or depressed. What I have finally learned to do is stop right then. And I've got that little inventory sheet right up here in my head. It's just as plain as day. And I say, okay, Charlie, who are you mad at? What did they do to you? What part of self is affected? What did you do, if anything, to set this in motion? Which character defect has come back to the surface? I can't get upset with somebody unless one of those character defects have come back to the surface. I can spot it almost immediately. And then I can say, now God, you know I don't want to be this way. Please take this selfishness away from me, or this dishonesty, or this inconsideration, or whatever it is. And then I try to discuss that with someone as soon as I can, preferably my sponsor. And then I make amends quickly if I've harmed anyone. And you know, in about 15 or 20 minutes, I can be through with that thing. It's left my mind, the resentment is gone, and the rest of the day is going to be okay. If I don't do that, if I don't take care of it at 10 o'clock, by 11 o'clock I've cussed somebody else out. And by 12 o'clock somebody's cussed me out. And by nighttime I'm an absolute basket case. I've wasted all the time that I want to waste in resentments and fear and anger and depression. You see, I've learned I don't have to live that way anymore. And I love to feel good. And I'm going to try to extract every moment out of the day that I possibly can feeling good rather than feeling bad. I don't have to be that way anymore if I don't want to. Now be very, very careful. Because if you buy into this idea, just like with step 6 and 7, if you buy into this idea, then from this day on, you are responsible for the way you feel, for how you think, for the things you do, and the actions that you take. I no longer have the luxury of blaming anything on Barbara. I can't blame anything on God. I can't blame anything on Mother and Dad. I can't blame anything on anybody but me. If I'm fouled up today, it must be because that's the way I want to be. Now let's face it, once in a great while, that's the way I want to be. Sometimes I like to be mad. Because when I'm mad, I can romp and stomp and raise hell with other people. And that gives me a comfortable feeling of superiority over other people. Sometimes I like to be afraid. Because I can use fear to rationalize and justify not doing something I really ought to go ahead and do, or just as importantly, to keep doing something I shouldn't be doing in the first place. But anymore, when I do that, I don't enjoy it like I used to. I catch myself about the middle of it, and I say, okay, Charlie, you're doing it to yourself again. And when I see that, then I'm willing to change it, and I start working on it again. A very, very definite, valuable step. Not only to keep us sober, but to continue our spiritual growth. I defy anybody in this room to work step 10 and stay the way you are. You absolutely cannot do that. As you continue to watch for selfishness, dishonesty, resentment, and fear, you learn more about yourself.
As you ask God to take these things away, they become less and less. As you discuss them with another human being, you learn more about yourself. As you make amends quickly, your relationship with the world and everybody in it will get better and better and better until you begin to move into an entirely new dimension of living. You know, it's great, absolutely great, to be able to live practically all day long free of anger, worry, depression, and etc. It is great to be able to be serene and peaceful and happy and free almost 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Now you notice I say almost, because none of us are perfect at it. But used to, I spent most of my time in anger, worry, depression, and etc. Today I spend most of my time in peace of mind, serenity, and happiness. A new dimension of living. I didn't know that you could live this way. Joe?
I was listening to Charlie thinking about going around being mad all day and letting those resentments keep popping up, not doing anything about them, getting sick and messing our lives up. Then the most ridiculous thing we do, we go to a meeting at night and tell everybody else about it.
Make them sick too. Now, if you work step 10 for a while, you're then going to encounter an entirely new set of promises.
Yeah.
We hear always about those on 83 and 84. Nobody ever talks about the promises on page 84 and 85. Let's see the results now of this kind of living.
Okay, we have a new set of promises, 12 more of them right here. We don't talk about these. And we have ceased fighting anything or anyone, even alcohol. For by this time, sanity will have returned. Remember in step 2, we said, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. After step 10, sanity has returned. And remember we said that specifically that sanity was our attitude toward alcohol. We were insane when it comes to alcohol only. This is the insanity we're looking at. Now we have been restored to sanity about alcohol. Let's see what happens after that. We'll be seldom interested in liquor. If tempted, we will cough it like a hot flame. We react sanely and normally toward liquor. And we will find that this has happened automatically. We will see that our new attitude toward liquor has been given us with any thought or effort on our part. It just comes. That is the miracle of it. We are neither fighting it, neither are we avoiding temptation. We feel as though we have been placed in a position of neutrality, safe and protected. We have not even sworn off. Instead, the problem has been removed. It does not exist for us. We are neither cocky nor we are afraid. This is our experience, and this is how we act so long as we keep in a fit spiritual condition.
You remember way back in page 45, we read a statement that said the main object of this book is to enable you to find a power greater than yourself, which will solve your problem. And we emphasized then that it didn't say it would help you solve it, or which would enable you to solve it. It said which would solve your problem. Now somewhere between page 45 and page 85, and I'm really not sure where, it might have been during step 4, it might have been 6, 7, or I don't know. But I woke up one morning, and I said, Charlie, there's something strange in your life this morning. And I said, what's that? And I said, you don't want to take a drink. And I said, how long has it been since you wanted to take a drink? And I couldn't remember. Somewhere in this process, God reached into my mind and plucked out the obsession to drink. And it's never returned since that time. Now, once again, He can't remove something from my mind and leave a blank spot there. I got enough holes in my heads already. He's not going to leave any more in there.
If he removes the obsession to drink, it's going to have to be replaced with something else. And the only thing that can replace it is the opposite of it. And today I believe my mind is just as obsessed with the idea of staying sober as it ever was with the idea of taking a drink. You see, an obsession of the mind is an idea that overcomes all ideas to the contrary. It is so strong it can make you believe a lie, and that's all we've looked at yet about the obsession. But also it can be so strong it can make you see the truth. Now the truth is, I cannot successfully drink alcohol. My mind is just as obsessed with that idea as it ever was with the idea of taking a drink. This is the miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous. This is why I don't drink today. I know me better than anybody in the world knows me. If I had to fight that obsession to drink on a daily basis, I know exactly what I'd do. I'd end up drunk all over again. That's what I always did before. But you see, I don't have to fight it because God has removed it. You know, if you and I spent just one-tenth of the time in working this program and trying to recover from alcoholism that we spent in trying to drink alcohol, God only knows what we could be today. You know, being a practicing alcoholic is hard, hard work. If you're going to be a practicing alcoholic, you got to be busy all the time. You've got to be willing to give alcohol everything you got. You got to give it your job. You got to be willing to give it your money. You got to be willing to give it your health. You got to be willing to give it your spouse. You got to be willing to give it your children. You got to be willing to give it your home. You got to be willing to give it your car. And you got to be willing to give it the thing that is most important in any human being, our own self-respect. You've really got to work to be a practicing alcoholic. If we would just spend a tenth of that time in the working of this program, then surely this miracle will occur for every one of us. And there's no limit to what we could actually become if we follow these changing steps, and especially these last three. Now be careful. If you receive this set of promises, life is really getting good now. You probably got back into the house by now. If you're real lucky, you might be back in the bedroom by now. The kids are probably speaking to you again. The dog has quit biting you when you come in the front door. You've probably got a job now. You got a little money. And you got wheels under you so you can move. And if you aren't careful, things start getting very, very important. And we begin to concentrate more on these things that we've received through our sobriety than we do upon the program that caused us to receive them in the first place. And the next thing you know, we start becoming complacent. We quit working on step 10. And then we start having trouble with people. And then we start having trouble with ourselves. And then we start having trouble with God. And the next thing you know, we're drunk all over again. There's no stopping place in this program. I wish there was, but there isn't. He tells me on page 85, it is easy to let up on the spiritual program of action and rest on our laurels. We're headed for trouble if we do. For alcohol is a subtle foe. We're not cured of alcoholism. What we really have is a daily reprieve contingent on the maintenance of our spiritual condition. Now there's your maintenance. On a daily basis, contingent on our spiritual condition for that day. Not forever, that day. Every day is a day when we must carry the vision of God's will into all our activities. How can I best serve thee, thy will not mine be done? These are thoughts which must go with us constantly. We can exercise our willpower along this line all we wish. It is the proper use of the will. Isn't this great? And step three, we made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understand Him. In steps 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, and 10, we've been working on the removal of self-will. And now then that we've removed enough self-will, they give us our will back. Because now we can use it for the proper purpose. To find out what God's will is, rather than what our will is. I think this is absolutely amazing that we get our will back at the end of step 10.
Okay. Now you notice that we always talk about the preciseness of the book. He doesn't give us our will back on page 85 until we get our sanity back on 84. We'd be dangerous if we got our will back. But we see as the steps unfold, as Charlie said, step as a result of 1 and 2, we make the decision to turn over our will. Then it's a process of 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. The action steps and 10 are things to remove the things that block us from God. And then in 11, we have received God's will. So we boil it down to its little finest points. It's 3 and 11. Turning over our will and receiving new will. Changing the directions in the human life through the whole process. So now we come to continue. Now that we have done all this work, the next thing is, how do we receive God's will? Much has already been said about receiving strength, inspiration, and direction.
Not suggestion, direction.
From who has all knowledge and power. If you have carefully followed directions,
not suggestions, directions,
you have begun to sense the flow of His Spirit into us. Already we should be sensing this. To some extent, we have become God-conscious already. We have begun to develop this vital sixth sense, but we must go further, and that means more action.
A vital sixth sense. You know, everything I know on a conscious level, I've learned through 5 senses of direction. I can see, I can smell, I can taste, I can touch, and I can hear. That's the normal 5 senses of direction. Now, you can take everything that I know and everything that Joe knows, and everything that you guys know, and everything that every human being on earth knows, and add it all together, and it's just a tiny, tiny, tiny speck of knowledge compared to the knowledge of the universe. Now, if God has all knowledge and all power, I'm convinced He does. And if God dwells within each of us, and my book says that He does, then it stands to reason you and I have within ourselves all the knowledge and all the power that we can ever need to handle any conceivable situation that would come up in the future, if we knew how to tap into that power. That is the sixth sense of direction. You remember way back in the appendix, appendix 2, when we talked about spiritual experience, it said we will know we've had a spiritual experience when we become aware of the fact we've tapped into an unsuspected inner resource of strength. Now, it's been long known to the human beings how you tap into that strength and that power, and that's through prayer and meditation. And most of us, just like we got here with hardly any knowledge of spirituality,
We got here all screwed up in our knowledge of our sex life. Most of us that get here just as fouled up in prayer and meditation as we do in anything else. You know, even raised in church, when I got here, I knew very little about prayer and meditation. Nothing at all about meditation. Very little about prayer. I had two prayers that I had used for many, many years prior to AA. One went like this: "Now I lay me down to sleep, I pray the Lord my soul to keep, and if I die before..." I don't like that prayer anymore. That's dealing with death, and I'm really not into that. The other prayer I use quite often, I'm sure you used it too, went like this: "God, if you get me out of this damn mess, I swear I'll never do this again." And now I'm going to have to try to develop a life of prayer and meditation. Would seem to be an impossible thing. Thank God Bill Wilson was a real alcoholic. Because he had the same thoughts and the same feelings, and he knew exactly what I was going to encounter when I got here. And now he's going to teach me through some suggestions as to how to pray and meditate.
Step 11 suggests prayer and meditation. We shouldn't be shy on the matter of prayer. Better man than we use it constantly. It works if we have the proper attitude and work at it. We have to work. It would be easy to be vague about this matter, yet we believe we can make some definite and valuable suggestions. And I have to go back and I'm amazed at this part of the book. We realize, you know, when Bill wrote this, he wasn't a spiritual giant. And here he was faced with a task of writing something on prayer and meditation for a group of people who were going to be spiritually bankrupt. He didn't know a lot about it. Look who he was talking to. And he says, "I wish I could be vague about this matter." You know, it seemed like he would like to avoid this issue.
I can't blame you.
You know, we think about prayer and meditation, as Charlie said, in the history of humans on face of this earth. We have dealt with those subjects extensively. Great minds have written many, many things on prayer. And quite naturally, the same as meditation, they are very broad subjects. And here was a man with no background at all in this, attempting to deal with it. And the amazing thing to me is he was able to accomplish the task on two and a half pages of this book. It has given millions of people lives of prayer and meditation. You know, I'm really glad Bill didn't know a lot about it. You know, most of the other authors that have talked to me and read and the things that most of the other people that talked to me about prayer and meditation, they knew so much about it, I couldn't understand what they were talking about. You know, but Bill didn't, thank God. Bill does not attempt, he didn't know it. He could not teach us anything about it. He does not attempt to teach you anything about prayer and meditation in this book. But he takes a different approach altogether. He says, "I'm going to give you some definite and valuable suggestions. And if you use these suggestions over a period of time, what happens? You will teach yourself a personal life of prayer and meditation." He does not teach you. He allows you to teach yourself. Now what he's going to do is real simple. He's going to tell you, you know, even a drunk can't mess this up.
It's pretty hard to do.
He's going to tell you what to do at night before you go to bed. Okay? Then he's going to tell you what to do in the morning when you get up. He does this paragraph by paragraph, like he always does, very clear. The bottom paragraph, the first paragraph will tell us what to do at night. The next paragraph tells us what to do in the morning. The next paragraph tells us how to handle indecisions throughout the day. And the first paragraph on the next page tells us how to pray. The bottom paragraph just throws in some little small mini suggestions that can also be helpful. Okay? Real simple. And it's all, and anybody that uses this, if you apply it to your day, sometime in the future, you will develop a personal life of prayer and meditation. Let's talk about at night. When we retire at night, we can instruct or review our day. Were we resentful, selfish, dishonest, afraid? Do we owe an apology? Have we kept something to ourselves should have been discussed with some person at once? And we see some steps in here. Were we kind and loving toward all? What could we have done better? Were we thinking of ourselves most of the times? Or were we thinking what we could do for others? Or what we could pack into the stream of life? But we must be careful not to drift into worry, remorse, or morbid reflections, for that would diminish our usefulness to others. After making my review, I ask God forgiveness and inquire what corrective measures should be taken. Just a few minutes at night before we can go, we can reflect back on that day and see what we could have done better, where we were wrong. And look at that day. You know, I've never had a perfect day. I had some great days, some great things happen in my life, but there's always something in my day I can see I could have done better and done different.
Here's the nighttime thing.
Yeah.
It's not in step 10, it's in step 11.
Yeah.
And if you'll notice on that paragraph Joe just read, we see once again the working of the steps. When he said, retire at night, we constructively review our day. That's step 4. Were we resentful, selfish, dishonest, or afraid? Do we owe an apology? That's step 5. And 8 and 9, have we kept something to ourselves which we discussed with another person at once? At the end of that paragraph, after making our review, we ask God's forgiveness and inquire what corrective measure should be taken, step 6 and 7. So really, we're doing it again at night. Reviewing 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, and 9. Seeing what our day has been, and then asking God to correct those things. Now, we made up a little sheet that you might want to use for a daily inventory. Use anything you want to, but this is one that we could use. See if it's plugged in. And on one side of this sheet, we have the personality characteristics of a self-willed human being. The other side, we have the personality characteristics of a God-willed human being. And all we've been trying to do is to get from one side of the sheet to the other. It only takes us a couple of minutes at night just to sit down, run down through this little sheet and make a few check marks, see where we've been that day, ask God's forgiveness, ask for the power to become the opposite, slowly, 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 over a period of time, we move from one side to the other side. Like Joe says, I've never found myself completely on either side, and I find that these things change around quite often. But over a period of years, we become more and more a God-willed human being. You can't do this step and do this little exercise and stay the way you are, because you learn more about yourself, and as you ask God's help and God's forgiveness, these character defects become less and less, and as they become less, the opposite becomes stronger and stronger, and gradually we become different human beings. Now, I've learned one thing in my sobriety for sure, and that is that I'm going to inventory. And I've got one or two choices. I can put it off and put it off and put it off and wait until I'm almost drunk and then start trying to dig myself out from under that mess with the possibility I might get drunk. Or I can do it on a daily basis, as the book suggests, and stay in good shape. And I found out it takes a lot less time and a lot less energy to do it on a daily basis than it does to wait till I'm so sick I'm almost drunk, with much less danger of drinking if I'll do it on a daily basis. I've learned I'm going to do it. I've tried it both ways. And I've learned that I'm going to do one of the two. I have to. No ifs, ands, or buts about it. And the daily basis is the easiest way to do it. A very valuable suggestion. Joe?
Okay. Now the next one deals with in the morning. What do we do in the morning? On awakening, let us think about the 24 hours ahead. We consider our plans for the day before we begin. We ask God to direct our thinking, especially asking that we be divorced from self-pity, dishonest, self-seeking motives. Under these conditions, we employ our mental facilities with assurance, after all, God gave us brains to use. Our thought life will be placed on much of our plane when our thinking is clear of the wrong motives. Now, this tells us what to do, how we get up in the morning, and a lot of us do our morning meditations. I think this is probably one of the definite valuable suggestions we use. A lot of people use it. But I always like to tell, if we use the night review in the morning, it gives us two times a day, two pillars in a day when we can really look at things. The morning meditation is great, but it works great when it's coupled with a night review also. You know, it just takes a few minutes to do this. You know, we're such busy, busy people. Busy going nowhere. You know, we can take 2.5 minutes in the morning and 2.5 minutes at night, and we still got 23 hours and 55 minutes to screw this thing up. You know?
Here's what most of us do in the morning when we get up. Yeah. First thing we do is we go to the bathroom.
Yeah.
Now, I had a guy tell me the other day the first thing he does is get on his treadmill.
Yeah.
And I said, boy, you got a hell of a lot better bladder than I have. I go to the bathroom. We get through with the bathroom, we run back to the kitchen.
Yeah.
And we get us a little coffee and maybe a little something to eat,
yeah,
feed the body, and then we run back to the bathroom.
Yeah.
We brush our teeth and men shave our faces and you ladies fix your faces and we all comb our hair. Joe doesn't have any problem with that. And after we get our faces and our head all fixed up, we run to the closet and we start picking out our clothes. Now we spend a lot of time on this because they've got to match and everything's got to be just perfect. And after we get our clothes all picked out and we get ourselves dressed and we put our coat on and we start out the door and we make sure we lock out to the car and we walk around the car and see if we got air in all the tires. And we get in the car and turn on the switch and check the fuel tank, see if we got fuel in it. And then we start the car and we take off for the day. Now we did all that stuff on the material well-being and on the body. But what do we do about our mind? Our mind's going to run the whole show all day long. What do we do about it? Did we feed it? Did we check the air in it? Did we check the fuel level there? The book says and suggests that we take just a few minutes in the morning and we have a little time with God. And we ask God for the right thought and the right direction. And that way we start the day with much less chance of getting screwed up. And it said while we're sitting there thinking about that day, we may face some indecisions. We may not be able to determine which course to take. And here we ask God for inspiration and intuitive thought or decision. We relax and take it easy. We don't struggle. We're often surprised how the right answers come after we've tried this for a while. Now, these last two paragraphs have dealt with meditation. It's always seemed odd to me. The step says prayer and meditation, but the book deals with meditation and then prayer. These last two steps are a form of, or last two paragraphs, excuse me, are a form of meditation for very, very busy people. You know, I always thought before I got to AA, if you were going to meditate, you would have to sit down or lay down and clear your mind of all thought. And I don't know about you guys, but I know about me. When I get up in the morning, that sucker turns on and it runs all day. I've never been able to clear it of all thought. I just can't shut it down. Sometimes I thought meditation was you would have to chant certain words or listen to certain kinds of music. And those are forms of meditation, okay. But for busy, busy, busy people, this is a form of meditation. And if we can't make a decision about what we're going to be doing today, we ask God for the right thought or action. We relax and take it easy, and I don't think it means to lay down. I think it means to get our mind off of that subject and get it off on something else. And the only way I can get my mind off on something else is to go do something different. Start painting the house. Mowing the grass, washing the dishes. And it's amazing how maybe 30 minutes later, an hour later, or maybe the next day, there's some information appears in my head that I didn't have before. And it said, why don't you call Joe and see what he thinks about this? And I called Joe, and hell, Joe's got the answer. And I used to say, my, wasn't it lucky I called Joe? No, that's information I didn't have before. Sometimes I'm standing in the supermarket checkout line talking to an absolute stranger and they give me the answer to what I was struggling with this morning early. And it's amazing how this takes place. Tapping into the unsuspected inner resource of strength. This is a form of meditation for busy people like us. Now he warns us a little bit about this on page 87.
He said, well, it used to be a hunch. We have all had this before. We have had hunches, but we have never been able to use it on a constant basis. With this, we can use it on a constant basis. Our occasional inspiration gradually becomes a working part of the mind. If we practice this, this will become a working part of the mind that we can use when we need it. But he said, being still in experience and having just made conscious contact with God, we're not probably going to be inspired at all times. If we knew it this, it takes time to practice it. We might pay for this presumption in all sort of absurd actions and ideas, and you do. Nevertheless, we find that our thinking will, as time passes in time, we will become more and more on a plane of inspiration. We come to rely upon it. This is something that we can work and work. It takes time. Once we get developed, we can rely upon it. We don't have to have. I don't have to go around with all the answers. I don't have to know it all anymore. I have a source of power. I have a source of information that I can tap into to get that information. He said, he's going to talk about how should we pray.
Now, one thing I found I had to be very careful about right here was that when I first started doing that, I found myself tending. Rather than to ask God for the right thought or action, I tended to tell God what I thought we ought to be doing that day. And then stick it out there and say, just stamp it and approve it and we'll go ahead with our business. You have to be a little bit careful here.
Yeah, you could con yourself into that stuff. This one I want done.